Testing with Visual Studio 2010. So I want to set some expectations about this session just right up front. This is a little bit different than the way that I normally deliver this session. I created this session because for the last 2 years I've been evangelizing Visual Studio 2010 and specifically the software testing capabilities within the product. And so I've been to Dev Days Netherlands before, I've been to Tech Ed Europe, and I've given a lot of 200-level presentations on what our manual testing story is and what our automated testing story is, which includes our lab management solution across Visual Studio 2010. And I've done this talk dozens of times, or those talks dozens of times, and then people get excited and they go off back to their organization, and then I start getting emails from people saying, okay, now I know what the tool is designed to do, but how does it really work in practice? How do I really embrace test case management? What happens if I'm, you know, balancing between these two decisions? Which ways do I go? So I developed the applied software testing talk as really a patterns and practices talk. And it's meant to roll up all of those different questions I've received over the years. I've delivered this session 3 or 4 times now, and every time it continues to evolve and I hope get better and better. The reason I want to set that expectation is that if you're not yet familiar with, at least at a 200 level, what our manual testing and test automation story is for 2010, you may not get a lot of value out of this session, and I won't be offended if you go watch the Royal Wedding or whatever you want to do on a Friday afternoon. So I just want to set that expectation. This is a 300-level talk, not because we're going to get into to any heavy-lifting technical mechanics like what you might see in one of my friend Bart DeSmith's sessions or something like that. It's really 300 level because I'm assuming that most people are familiar at least somewhat with what we're doing around testing in 2010. So with that in mind, quick show of hands, how many people have not yet played with or looked into our manual testing story around 2010? Okay, just a few of you out there. Let me just really quickly position that so you understand the investments we've made in 2010. So when we were looking into what we could do in the software testing space, we realized that automated testing actually is pretty well served. I mean, there's, you know, a dozen unit testing frameworks. There's lots of different ways for me to write scalability tests and load tests and things of that nature. But for the most part, manual testers were really left out in the cold with respect to the open source and the vendor provided tools that they can use to start embracing software testing. And so with 2010, we introduced a new product called Microsoft Test Manager. It allows a manual tester to organize their test plans, to author and execute test cases. And one of the really nice things about that story is as I'm running my test cases as a manual tester, we actually collect rich diagnostic information behind the scenes. So that as a developer, the hope is that you don't just get a bug like you've done in the past and you look at maybe a one-line description and you say, well, you know, it works on my machine. And the tester says, no, it's really a bug. And you say, well, you know, what build are you running and what type of machine are you running? And you have all this ping pong dialogue going back and forth. But really in 2010, they can run those tests and they can get a really actionable payload, if you will, of data that says, hey, this is the build they ran, this is the type of system they were running on. And as a developer, you can look at that and go, ah, I see, they're running a 32-bit machine. That might be a clue about where we need to dig in. So that's our manual testing story in a nutshell. We also provide a new lab management solution that allows you to set up a full build, deploy, test workflow. I know there's some other sessions this week happening about lab management. I'm not going to be showing lab management, but I do have a section in here which rolls up some of those best practices. Okay? So hopefully that kind of level sets the room and lets you know what it is that we're working on. So I work for Microsoft. I've been on the Visual Studio team for the last 9 years. I'm on Channel 9. I always show my blog during my presentations, not because I need a lot of blog followers, but I just want to make everyone aware that I put all of my virtual machines and all of my hands-on labs online. So most of the demos that you see me do at conferences are available online. And also those 200-level presentations I've given, like I gave last year at Dev Days, where I sort of position Microsoft Test Manager and our lab management story, you can go watch videos of me delivering those online. I also worked on a couple of books, one on professional application lifecycle management and one dedicated on Team Foundation Server. So, for today, I want to make sure that everyone in this room can effectively adopt Visual Studio 2010 for your testing efforts. Part of that is making you aware of the testing capabilities that are within the product and making you aware of what those testing capabilities are best applied for. I talked to a lot of people that own Visual Studio Ultimate, and they own Team Foundation Server, and they're not even aware of some of the capabilities that are in there. So part of my job is to try to make sure that you're at least aware of the tools that you may already own and can go back and start applying right away. So we're going to start by going over the testing types and tools. That's kind of a 100-level introduction. Then we're going to dive straight into formal test case management. So how do I really take a formal approach using the Microsoft Test Manager tool set to organizing my test plans, to organizing and authoring my test cases, and then making sure that those are designed in such a way so that the reports light up effectively? And then we're going to look at exploratory testing, which some people kind of look at the approach to testing as either formal or exploratory. I actually think there's room for both, and within Microsoft, we use both in order to make sure that we have the best shot at finding bugs. And I'm going to show you how our tool set can be applied to finding exploratory testing bugs. I'll talk a little bit about test automation. If you were in my session yesterday, I talked about coded UI tests and the evolution of a manual test case into an automatic coded UI test. I'll just revisit some of those principles here. Test settings and configurations is another important one to kind of wrap your head around in terms of making sure that the tests you run are actually run across all the different types of environments that you might expect your software to be run in the wild. And then finally, I have a lot of slides which I won't get into detail on, but I usually include them just as an FYI so that as you start going out and implementing lab management, you know about some of the resources, some of the blog posts, some of the additional tools that we've shipped since that product RTM'd so that you can really have the best shot at adopting that within your organization. Okay? And by the way, I normally deliver this as a 60-minute session, so I'm optimistic that we'll have a little bit of time at the end for questions. So if you could just hold your questions to the end, and then we'll make sure that we try and do some live Q&A here. So testing types and tools. In Visual Studio 2008, these are the types of tests that we had. We introduced unit tests within the product in 2005. We introduced database unit tests as a way that you could actually write T-SQL unit tests against SQL Server. And we've got partners that actually provide database unit tests for platforms such as DB2 and Oracle. Web tests were a way in the product, in the last version of the product, that you could author scenarios where a user would walk through adding an item to their shopping cart or walk through and creating a new account against your website. And at the time, that was the only way that we could actually validate application functionality as well. So they were kind of generally positioned as both helping you to helping you to create application functionality tests, but also you could fire those up into a load test as well. And with a load test, you can say, what happens if I have 2,000 users hitting my website at the same time, and then 500 users are shopping for items on my website, 1,000 users are checking out. And you can kind of break down different scenario mixes to see what happens at different times during the year. You know, maybe during the holiday season, you have a lot of people placing orders, and then after the holiday season, you have a lot of people returning orders. So how does that mix, and what is the performance impact on your website? We did support manual tests in 2005 and 2008, but it was very rudimentary. It was basically a text file that you authored some commands in, and then you could track that as part of your testing effort. But it did not capture any of that rich payload information like what we do in 2010, and it really wasn't a first-class manual testing solution at all there. Generic tests are basically a way for you to pipe third-party tests into Visual Studio so that you can test and report on those tests against our testing framework. So you can point this at NUnit or JUnit or whatever other type of testing framework you have and basically pass in command line arguments. It's pretty rudimentary, but it's basically a way for you to represent that within our list of tests and the corresponding testing infrastructure there. Ordered tests are just a container for other tests. So you could have a unit test which creates a new account in a database, another one which performs some some edit action against that account, and then another action that goes out and deletes that from the database. And you might want to represent that as three different unit tests and then order those so that they can correspond and go in the right order there. And then you can actually report on that entire ordered test as a whole if you want to as well. So if the first one fails, we actually don't have to run the other two. We can actually just report on that as failing. In 2010, we have unit tests still. We have database unit tests. I'm not talking a lot about those today because they really didn't change in the 2010 product. We are doing a lot of stuff for that in the next release, but that's all I can say right now. So if you do a lot of unit testing, stay tuned for some more information on what we're doing in the next release there. Web performance tests are the new name for what used to be web tests. The reason for that is that if you're doing functionality testing against a website, a better test type is going to be a coded UI test. And really, web tests are still in the product there, primarily to help you create tests that you can then load into a load test. And so we actually renamed this test type to make it a little bit more aptly suited to the purpose that it is designed for in 2010. So they're still in the product, but you'll see them renamed as web performance tests. And then, of course, load tests are the same. Manual tests are now first-class work items within Team Foundation Server, and those are what we'll be working with today, just represented as test cases. If you have existing legacy manual tests from 2005 and 2008, search for a tool called TCM Import. It's out on CodePlex, and that can take your existing manual tests that may be represented within Word or Excel, and that can migrate those forward into 2010 as first-class test cases. Generic tests are unchanged, ordered tests are unchanged, and then coded UI tests are what I showed yesterday. If you weren't in my session yesterday, basically this is our functional UI testing type. And so you can record the actions through the UI of an application, and then you can play those back, and along the way you can also validate things, such as what is the value of this text box, or does this text appear as black 12-point font. So there's lots of really interesting things you can do there. This isn't a marketing talk, but a lot of people ask, how do I actually obtain this functionality? How do I, you know, make sure that I'm properly licensed to use this? So I just wanted to quickly show you the SKU slide here. We changed our SKU structure, so now we have Visual Studio Professional, Premium, and Ultimate are the primary developer SKUs, and then we have Test Professional as well. Test Professional is really how you get that manual testing product. So if you're a manual tester, there's no need to go out and buy Visual Studio, you know, Professional or Ultimate. You just get the Test Professional product, and that gives you the Microsoft Test Manager tool along with the necessary license you need to connect back to Team Foundation Server. The reason you might want to use Visual Studio Premium as a step up from Professional is if you wanted to start taking advantage of coded UI tests. And then if you wanted to go up to web and load tests, then you should get Visual Studio Ultimate. And I'm not sure if everyone saw the announcement last month, but if you have Visual Studio Ultimate with an MSDN subscription, we're now giving away unlimited number of virtual user packs so that you can simulate between one and, you know, however many users you need to simulate, and you can actually simulate it against your hardware when creating a load test. So if you go out to MSDN, we'll have more details on how to claim your free virtual user packs there. And then actually one thing I missed here is lab management. So lab management is a capability of Team Foundation Server. So it's basically something you just enable from within Team Foundation Server. It does require that you set up SCVMM, System Center Virtual Machine Manager, in order to manage the underlying virtual machines. But we give you a dev and test license for SCVMM along with TFS. So you don't need to buy anything extra there. The other thing that you do need, though, is the people who actually connect to the lab managed environment need to have Microsoft Test Manager. And to get that, you either buy Test Professional or Visual Studio Ultimate. Okay? I promise that's all the marketing I'm going to do today, unless you have questions, of course. So let's talk about formal test case management. This is a formal test case management diagram, which really resembles the way that we thought about building Microsoft Test Manager and how we resemble test plans and represent test cases and the life cycle that they move through. This probably mirrors what most of you are doing already with your test case management, but if it doesn't, you don't need to worry about whether or not what you do matches exactly what we do. This is just guidance. You can really adopt the tool set however you wish, but a lot of people ask me, you know, how does Microsoft do it, and they want to take a look at that in terms of figuring out how they adopt this for their own organizations. So let me just take you through this quickly from left to right. At the very beginning of a product, whether or not this is a greenfield product that's never been built before, or maybe it's a revision, so you're moving from version 1 to version 2, that's a good time to actually sit down and talk about your overall testing strategy, right? And as part of that conversation, one of the first things that I always tell people is to define what done is, right? So we all know the concept of done. Programmer checks in some code and says, yeah, that feature's done, right? And then you go out and you say, oh, great, let me actually start playing with this. And you notice that there's no documentation for that feature. And you notice that you know, it works on 64-bit, but you have a 32-bit machine and it doesn't really work for you. And you notice that it's not actually localized. And there's this whole checklist of things that the customer expects when you tell them that a feature is done. But as a programmer, when we're just checking in code and saying, all right, tick that box, the first iteration of this is done, I'll finish the rest of the stuff later, it's not quite done yet. And so this is a good time for everyone to get on the same page and decide, all right, what's our definition of done, and what's our definition of done? So within Visual Studio, you may have noticed that we actually ship betas, you know, once or twice before we get to the actual RTM of a product. Beta 1 is almost never localized. It's English only. By the time we get to beta 2, we usually localize the product into at least one other language. It's typically Japanese. And then by the time we RTM, of course, then we've localized the product into, I think it's 9 or 10 different languages now. So that would be done, but beta 1 is not quite done, right? So you should have these discussions internally. Establish the environment. So this is the time you start thinking about what hardware do we need to test all these different configurations. Can we take advantage of virtual machines? Can we take advantage of lab management? You talk to the marketing team and say, where is this product actually expected to run? Are we supporting Internet Explorer 6 still, or can we just test for IE 7, 8, and 9? So those are the types of discussions you want to have here. Review those configurations against what you're currently testing. So maybe there's some existing hardware, some existing processes that you can plug into, which already give you a lot of the same test environments, and you can just reuse existing systems. A lot of the time I talk to customers about their existing hardware labs that they use for testing, and those testing labs are far from being 100% utilized. A lot of the reason for that is that a lot of testing labs haven't fully embraced virtualization yet. And so once you can start embracing virtualization, then you can have a single physical box that may contain dozens of different virtual machine configurations, and you just power those up and down as needed in order to take advantage of the test runs you need to run at that moment. And then generate your test plans, which I'll show you in the product, and then generate data as well. So a lot of you that may work in a financial institution, for example, you may not have access to real customer production data that you can test against. So this is a good time to think about what is the data that we're going to pipe into the system that can help us do that. In 2005, Microsoft introduced the Database Professional product, and one of the key capabilities of that is the ability to easily generate test data. So we look at the existing schema of your database, and we generate some random test data that you can then use to populate those databases. So if that's something that you're looking for, I would encourage you to take a look at the database project now that's in Visual Studio 2010, because that's a really nice feature to be able to just pump out thousands or millions of rows of data that you might need. So that's the far left side. And so then once you get into actually planning your iteration, you're going to take a look at what the product team is building, so what the development team is creating, and you're going to start taking those requirements or those features or those user stories, doesn't matter what you call it, you're going to start adding those to your test plan that represents iteration 1. You're going to start adding the acceptance criteria to that. You're going to figure out if there's any regression tests from previous iterations that you want to carry forward into that plan. So if it's a greenfield project, of course, you won't have any of those in iteration 1. But if you're testing version 2 and it's your first iteration of version 2, you may have some stuff from version 1 that you want to carry forward as a regression test. And then you define the test settings, which we'll talk about in a moment. After that, you start authoring those tests, running those tests, filing bugs, verifying fixes, You decide which tests out of those you may want to automate. So after the UI has started to stabilize and after test cases have started to pass on a regular basis, it may make sense to stop testing those manually every day and then switch those over to automated tests. So you could create coded UI tests, you could create web tests, unit tests. There's lots of different tests that may map differently for the type of feature you're trying to test. But by moving that out of the manual test team's purview, I guess, then it gives them the resources back so that they can start testing new features that are coming online. And then, of course, you go back and you update what's called a master plan, which I'll show you what that means within our tool set in a moment. You identify any product debt that you may have, any test debt. A lot of teams take a look at their past iterations during a retrospective, and they realize that, hey, we actually, you know, missed a lot of changes that were coming down the pipe, or we found bugs too late. And as part of the retrospective, you should really be taking a look at how do you retool yourselves for the next iteration so that those things don't happen again. And a lot of people say, okay, well, we need to create more automated tests, and we need to make sure that we have automated tests created sooner so that the manual testers can focus on the new stuff that's coming in. And that may be the solution, but more often than not, when I talk to testing teams, they actually find that it's the other stuff which is taking their time away from performing their tests. And that other stuff could include setting up lab environments or making sure that we have access to the hardware when we need it. And that's where I think a solution like lab management comes in, because that can automatically create those environments for you. It can help you utilize that hardware better so that when you need it, you can just spin up that virtual machine, go back to the snapshot at the point in time that it contains, you know, Thursday night's build, and then it has everything ready for you. And then finally, you're going to release, and you're going to go through your regular set of release criteria, which our product doesn't really have anything explicit for a release right now. But obviously, you can go back and look at all your regression tests and your critical tests and pull all those tests forward for one final test pass. So in Microsoft Test Manager, we have this concept of test plans. And test plans are a way for you to represent a container of testing that your team is going to be working on. And there's this sort of this tendency that from teams that I talk to have just one big giant plan that they start working against. And in some cases that may be okay. The problem with that is that having one giant plan makes it kind of difficult to actually understand from a reporting perspective how we're actually performing against a current iteration of work. And so on the development side, we break down work into iterations or sprints or whatever the name is that you use within your team to actually time box work that you're doing. And so on the test side, why don't we do the same thing? Why don't we actually have a plan for every iteration that the development team is working with, and then we'll just track the new work that's being produced, we'll carry forward any regression tests, and for the most part that works just fine. But then there's also a nice way to capture some overall tests that you need to use throughout your plan within a master plan as well. And so this is a technique that I've worked with a lot of teams on, and it really works quite well. Let me take you through it, and then it'll become a little bit more obvious as to what it does. So within a master plan, you want to capture, to start with, all of your doneness tests. So at the beginning where we defined, you know, what is done look like, what is done look like, that can actually translate into a suite of doneness tests so that you can say, all right, anytime a feature is done, it needs to have documentation, localization, it needs to be tested for both left to right and right to left character sets, you know, whatever the set of doneness tests is within your organization that makes sense. Then you can look at any regression tests, and at the beginning you probably won't have any regression tests within this particular category, but by putting your regression tests into the master plan, it makes it really easy when you spin up new iterations to pull all those forward into subsequent plans so that you make sure that you don't pick or you don't leave anything behind. And then you can have these critical tests as well. And a critical test is best described by telling you a story about a guy on my team, Mark Midland. And he used to work at a company, and I think the CEO's name was Steve or something like that, which I guess he has a habit of working for guys named Steve. But the idea with a critical test was that they would try to look at all their test cases and predict which ones would make Steve look bad. And these are the tests that if they had a limited period of time to run against a given build, those are the tests that they focus on to try to make sure that they're running so that if they push out to production and something breaks, is Steve going to look bad when he's talking to the press about this particular feature? I used to work with a social networking website that should remain nameless here, but they used to push to production twice a day. So they would create, new feature work, and they would push it to production in the morning, and they would push it to production in the afternoon. And they recognized that their ability to rapidly create new features and push it out to their customers was far more important than the risk of introducing some breaking change. They had a motto that said that, we're not a banking institution. The worst thing that could happen is you might lose a few friends, right? Which is kind of a comical way of looking at it. But the reality is that's the way that they chose to run their business, and it worked quite well for them, at least for the time that they were in. And what they would do is they would push changes out to a staging server, and they would give the manual testing team 5 minutes to actually test everything. If they didn't catch any bugs, then they would push it out to production, and at that point, it would be up to their users to actually perform the work as the testers and let them know if something broke. And so if you're a manual tester and you've got 5 minutes to test something, you need to make sure you know what your critical tests are. And so those get captured in this critical test category. Now, when you spin up your first iteration, then you're going to create another test plan, which is time-boxed for that given iteration of testing that you're working on. You're going to pull forward all of your user stories that represent what the development team is doing for this given iteration. And you're going to create acceptance tests that define what we expect the user can and can't do within this given user story. And then you're going to pull down the doneness tests as well. You're going to do the same thing for your next user story, pull down those doneness tests. You might customize some of those doneness tests if they don't make sense for the given user story. So for example, maybe if we're talking about making sure that every feature has documentation, and you're talking about a non-functional requirement, like making sure that we can scale to 2,000 users, well, obviously that doesn't need user documentation for that particular feature. It's a non-functional requirement. So we'll back out that particular doneness test and do what makes sense for that requirement. And then as you go through this, you're going to start creating regression tests as well. So we're going to identify automatic tests that we can create and then pull those off of the plate of the manual tester. And then you may create critical tests as well. So what would make Steve look bad? Going to then, at the end of that iteration, take all of those regression tests and all of those critical tests, and you're going to push those forward up into your master plan. And then you're on to the next iteration where you're doing the same thing, but you're pulling down all of those regression tests and all of those critical tests to make sure that you're continuing to track that as part of your iteration. So this is where you can start seeing where having multiple test plans makes sense, because now I can actually report on a given test iteration, and I can say, okay, for iteration 2, how is my testing plan coming? Looking back on iteration 1, let's compare and say, how quickly are we finding bugs as compared with iteration 2? And so really, those iteration separations are nice to be able to go back and report. And of course, with Team Foundation Server, we give you a lot of out-of-the-box reports that start to light up what you're doing in each one of these different areas. You're going to do this same thing. You're going to push forward any critical tests, any regression tests, and eventually you're going to release your software. So from a timeline perspective, how does this look? I mentioned time boxing a given iteration. Sometimes the test iterations actually come on a week or two after the development iterations. So if the development iteration is starting on January 1st, your test iteration may actually start on January 15th. And so that may be represented within your plan. Or you may say, we're going to start them both on January 1st because as the developers are writing code, we're going to be writing our tests. We can't execute those tests until the features are ready, but at least we can be writing those tests. So the development team is going to go out. They're going to do some work. They're going to implement user story 1. Meanwhile, we're writing tests against user story 1. We can start writing our tests against user story 2, but we need to make sure that those tests for user story 1 are ready so that the moment those features are marked as ready, we can start testing them. After the development team has implemented user story one, we can start testing user story one and filing bugs against that user story. Meanwhile, the development team is working on user stories two. You know, there's no rocket science here. After they start getting some bugs, they're going to be fixing those bugs. We need to make sure that we have time on the testing team to actually validate those bugs. So it's not enough for the developers to just check in the fixes and say, yep, this bug is done. Oftentimes, we want to run that back through the testing team and make sure that it's actually closed out. And then finally, we're going to spend some time at the end of the iteration, not implementing new features, but just fixing bugs. And then the test team gets a chance to verify that and sign off on that given release before it potentially goes out to the customer. So that's enough slides for now. Let's drop into Microsoft Test Manager, and I'll show you how this starts to work. So for those of you that are familiar with Microsoft Test Manager, some of this is going to be review. On the left-hand side here, you have all of the test suites that represent your given test plan. You can see that I'm currently planning iteration 2 up there. So we have a few different types of test suites that you can work with. The first is a requirements-based test suite. And so requirement is our term within the tool, but again, that could map to user stories, features, really whatever it is that you use to describe a piece of functionality you're delivering to the user. And so these user stories actually came straight from within Team Foundation Server. So I started by creating a new requirements-based suite, and that's what you see here. And if I open up that particular requirement, you can see the user story, which is stored as a work item within Team Foundation Server. And then over on the right-hand side here, you can see the individual test cases that I've written that test that given user story. You can notice here that user story number 9, the tests here, have not been written yet. So I just set the status of this user story to in planning. So that tells the test team that they don't need to actually test anything against that. And so then when they switch over to the test tab, as a manual tester coming in each morning, this is where I get the list of work that I need to perform. So here I can see user story 7. There's some test cases in here. Some of them failed the last time we ran them. Some of them passed. User story 8, same thing. These are blocked, actually. So this is what I may indicate to my test team to say, hey, look, you know, we can't create new user accounts right now. So as a result, we can't actually log into the website. So there's no sense trying to run these tests. Okay? So what I might want to do is I might want to start elevating some of these test cases to be regression tests. So one way I can do that is I can start by creating a new suite. Actually, I wanted to create a query-based suite. I'll create a query-based suite. And a query-based suite allows us to query the existing test cases that are in my team project. And because test cases are just work items within Team Foundation Server, there's a lot of really interesting things that we can query here so that we're automatically pulling forward the test cases that we're interested in into this particular suite. And so here we'll just call this our regression test for iteration 2. And I meant to come in here and say iteration ID is equal to iteration path is equal to iteration 2, and automation status is equal to automated. So if I save this query right now, there's actually not going to be anything in it because I haven't yet created an automated test. And so I mentioned some of this yesterday if you were in my other talk, where you can actually use the workflows within your test cases to represent test cases that you might want to elevate into an automated status. So let's say that this is a test case that I want to create an automated test from. What I might do as a manual tester is switch this over to planned automation status, save this, and now as a developer, I'm going to switch over into Visual Studio. And I'm going to open up the project where I have all of my tests, or all of my tests, rather. And so let's say that I've already written the test that I want to use to automate this. It might be a unit test. It might be a coded UI test. What I can now do is switch over to my work items. and look at my test cases, and here's the test that I wanted to automate. And so here you can see it's in a planned automation status. And all I need to do is switch over to the associated automation tab here and click the ellipsis and actually point this at an existing test. So again, this could be a coded UI test. It could be a unit test. It might be multiple tests that actually correspond to testing this particular feature. So maybe I've written multiple unit tests that need to be run in order to validate that this feature works correctly. If you want to create multiple tests and bind those back to an individual test case, you can't actually select multiple test cases or multiple tests from within here, but what you can do is create an ordered test and add all of the tests that you want to that ordered test and add that ordered test right within the associated automation. And by default, if any of the tests within that ordered test fail, then the entire test case will fail, and that, of course, will trigger that requirement to show up as currently broken within your reports. So at this point, I'll go ahead and save that. Whoops, I didn't want to save that. I wanted to save the work item. And now when I switch back over to my test plan, and I refresh, then this automatically shows up as a test case that is automated. And so I could also, if I wanted to, right-click on this and actually, from within the test tab, could right-click on this and run that test case. So I don't have an environment set up to actually run automatic test cases, but if you did, then you could run that test case from within Microsoft Test Manager. It would run within the environment that it's supposed to run to and then report back as to the status. It could also be now run and set up as part of your automated builds so that we automatically run any of the automatic test cases out of your individual test plan every night. And so you could set this up on a nightly basis. I come in the morning and I quickly look at all my automated tests. If anything failed, I can either determine whether or not I could create a bug from this. Maybe it was a false positive, or maybe I think it's a false positive, so I just rerun that test case and see exactly how it runs again. So there's lots of options that you have here. And then, of course, the other thing I can do is create a critical test container. So what would make Steve look bad? And one way I might want to represent that is by saying anything that's under iteration 2. Where the priority is less than 2. And so now we don't have anything that's currently in that status, but if we decided that this particular test case needed to be high priority, then we could set that in here, save that out. And now when my development team tells me, hey, I have 5 minutes to actually test this build before it goes to production, I scramble over to my critical test category, and then these are the tests that I run. So that's how I represent this on an individual iteration plan. How does the master plan play into this? So if I switch over to my other plan, which is a master plan, you'll notice that I have a few different categories of tests. And so one of the things I might want to do is carry forward all of my critical tests from my different test plans. So what I can do is actually copy a test plan by copying that suite from the other iteration. And now this is represented within this particular master plan. The other thing I can do is take a look at my doneness test, and this is where I'm going to capture all of those done requirements. And then those can be pulled forward into subsequent iterations as well. So if I switch over to iteration 2, and I say, okay, you know, I'd like to add all of my doneness plans to this particular requirement, one of the things I can do is actually copy that category into this. Now I have all of my doneness tests in here, and I'll drag and drop those up to 7. Whoops, that's not what I wanted to do. I actually wanted to copy, not move. And now those will show up on requirement number 7. I can do the same thing here. paste them in here. And so this is just the process that you go through where every time you're creating a new requirement, you can copy those plant or copy those doneness tests into that particular requirement. Just makes it really easy to have that list of doneness tests ready. When I then switch over to my next iteration, I can create a new plan here. Iteration 3. I can carry forward those existing critical tests from the other plan. And now I've already got everything that's ready for me so that I can start continuing to run those critical tests and continuing to track those, which is the important thing, under this new iteration. Okay? So some of that stuff is commonsensical. You know, I hope I'm not belaboring some of these points, but it really does show how you can move through multiple iterations, take advantage of those master plans as kind of containers for the overall list of all the doneness tests, all the critical tests, all those regression tests, and then carry forward those and make sure that you don't forget things that were important in earlier iterations as you're caring for and starting new iterations. Now, exploratory testing is a little bit different because with exploratory testing, we don't always know exactly what type of tests we're going to go out and execute. A lot of the things that I hear when I talk to people about exploratory testing are, you know, it's agile testing. It's no detailed test planning. It's lightweight testing, right? And all of these things are true. However, when you talk to managers about exploratory testing, these are the types of objections that I hear. You know, it's ad hoc monkey testing. If you think about the Shakespeare analogy, if I put 40 monkeys in a room with typewriters, eventually they would crank out every work of Shakespeare, right? Well, managers don't like that word eventually. It could take me a millennium before they crank out every work of Shakespeare, and they probably would for 40 monkeys tied to typewriters. The other challenge with exploratory testing is that there's no way to track it. You know, if you look across a team and say, who's doing what? What have we tested? What areas did we miss? That can become much trickier with exploratory testing, whereas with formal test case management, it's very easy to say, okay, we put in this input and we ran it 10 times and we got this output. And then the other thing, of course, is that people say that exploratory testing creates poorly documented bugs. If you get a bug from a tester that says, well, I was over in this particular area of the form for about 40 minutes, and eventually I hit this exception, I'm not exactly sure what I did, that's not a very valuable bug, right? And those can be legitimate concerns, but there are some ways that you can address those and still embrace exploratory testing. So one of the ways that I suggest is to take a look at themes. There's a guy named James Whitaker who's famous for this. He's written a couple of books. He actually used to work on our team. Now he works at Google. But he still continues to preach this idea of exploratory testing. And the idea with exploratory testing is that even if you have very experienced testers on your team, you need to give them some idea of where they should spend their exploratory testing efforts. Otherwise, you can't really be guaranteed that you're getting consistent coverage across your entire team. So we've done this within Microsoft. Every Friday afternoon, for example, we might have an exploratory testing team where we invite everyone to the team to come into the room and say, hey, what happens if we use really, really, really big strings in every one of the UI dialogues? Or what happens if we all turn off our monitors and try to use an accessibility tool to make sure that we can actually navigate the way somebody that's seeing impaired might navigate through the system? Those are some things that it wouldn't really be time effective to create formal test cases for each one of those scenarios. But with an exploratory testing hat on, you can just take a look at the dialogues and say, let me just fill up all of these different text boxes with really, really long strings and see what happens. And eventually you may find an important bug there. The other thing that we can do is we can start assigning metrics to exploratory testing. And because our tool set records pretty much everything you're doing, you can get some pretty interesting metrics. And you start looking at reports between iteration 1 and iteration 2, and you say, where did the majority of our bugs come from? Did they come from formal test cases, or did they come from exploratory tests? Did we have a lot of bugs related to localization, to running on foreign character sets? You know, maybe that's an area where we need to really double down our testing investment moving forward. And then you can also create rich bugs as well. As I mentioned, Microsoft Test Manager gives you this ability to capture a really nice payload of information so that you don't just have this scenario where a tester says, hey, I spent 45 minutes over here and I got an exception. But they can actually submit a video recording, an IntelliTrace file, system information that says what build they were running, what version of Internet Explorer, you know, this is how much memory I had when I got this bug. Lots of interesting stuff there. And so hopefully that's enough to dispel exploratory testing as being a potentially bad thing for approaching your tests. Some of the themes for exploratory testing can actually be pretty interesting. You know, if you think about taking a trip to Rome. I was actually there last October, and if you look at any of the guidebooks, they always say, you know, if you just have one afternoon in Rome, you should go hit the Forum and the Colosseum and blah, 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 and there's like a four-hour thing that everybody can do. And obviously, it's really important if you're the test manager for Rome's tourism board to make sure that tourists can come to the city and they can go to the Colosseum and they can go to the Forum and they can have that experience. But if you have a little bit longer to spend in Rome and, you know, maybe you're there over a weekend, you might want to do like a back alley tour, and you might want to go into a district where you're doing some wine tasting. And you don't always need somebody to tell you street by street, door by door where you're going. This is more of an exploratory off the beaten path testing tour, but it's just as important to somebody who might be spending some time in Rome. So how can we approximate that with software testing? Well, if you're a website like Amazon.com, obviously the formal test cases that you're going to write are going to look something like a customer can log into a site, they can search for a book, and then they can pay for that book, right? That's a really critical thing for Amazon.com, otherwise they go out of business. But for another class of users, there's also some other important stuff that happens as well. You know, I think about my mom, and she's much less likely to go shopping online. She's a little bit wary of people stealing her credit card, that kind of thing. And so for her, it might be really important when she gets to the last page of the checkout experience to say, hey, before I enter my credit card information, I want to understand exactly what's going to happen. And she could look around that screen and say, how do I actually contact customer support? Or how do I call somebody? Is there a phone number here that I can call and say, hey, what happens after I, you know, click on continue here? And so that's the type of exploratory testing you might want to write, which is kind of a back alley tour. Make sure that from every page within your application, there's a contact us button that appears at the bottom. Maybe there needs to be a privacy policy button as well so that you can actually click through to that and understand, okay, I understand that my credit card information is being treated in a secure fashion. So those are the types of things you may want to come up with. And if you look at James Whitaker's books, he has lots of really good examples of things that you would have never caught by writing formal test cases, but things where it's really interesting that you can find from an exploratory testing perspective. And then after that, you can also create formal test cases from that. Of course, if you've used our Microsoft Test Manager product or Team Foundation Server, you know that there's all sorts of different metrics that we give you within that product. And then the rich bugs as well, which I already talked about. And then this mainstreaming of exploratory testing as well is important. So let me actually, rather than talk to that, let me show you what that looks like within our tool set. If I come back to iteration 2, I can create a new bucket of tests down here. We'll call them exploratory tests. And then in order to actually start an exploratory testing session, you need to have at least a placeholder test case. And so what I can do is I can say add a test case. Whoops, not a suite. New test case. And I can say test for really long strings to make sure the UI behaves appropriately, which I can't spell, but I'm not going to fix it right now. Open application, start filling in long strings, and see what happens. And you can keep these really informal and ad hoc. I mean, at the end of the day, it's exploratory testing, right? And so now I can take this test, and I can start to run it. And I'm going to click this button here that says Create Action Recording. I'll go ahead and start this test. And let's just open up the application. So, you know, I might start by typing some things like hello world. Click on go. And that looks pretty good. And, you know, maybe I might try a longer string. And now I'm starting to see some problems here. So it actually starts to truncate these longer strings. So I may decide that this is a bug. Let me actually just do a really long one here, just for good measure. Click on go. And now let's go ahead and file what's called an exploratory testing bug. And so what I'll do to start with is I'll actually create a snapshot here so that we can illustrate to the tester exactly what's going on, or to the developer. Create an exploratory testing bug. And then here, when you create an exploratory testing bug, you actually get this time range. And the idea with the time range goes back to what I was saying earlier about how you may have a 45-minute exploratory testing session before you actually hit a bug. And because we capture lots of rich diagnostics about the application, what was going on in the event log, what was going on in the video recording, what was going on from a click-by-click perspective, we want to give you the ability to at least scope some of that down to the period of time where you actually encountered this bug. So here you can see I was running this test case for 52 seconds. I know that the very first time I tried it, just typing in hello world, that worked okay. It's only when I got to the maybe last 30 seconds I started to find those bugs. And so what I can do is I can trim this down and I can say create a bug based on the last 23 seconds. So I use that range to create the bug, typing a really long string, causes label and text box format badly. I'll assign that to my friend Abu. And then here you can see that we actually already have an attachment. Actually, we should have had an attachment. Should have had that screenshot. I must have clicked on something wrong there. But that's not important. So at this point, we'll go ahead and save and close this. And now Abu has that bug. So we could continue running another exploratory test. We could keep going through here. We could file another exploratory testing bug if we wanted to, and it would automatically scope to the time range since the last time we found the bug, and we could narrow that if we needed to. So now let's say that Abu has everything that he needs in order to work on that bug, and he fixes that, and now we want to make sure that we capture that moving forward. So if we come to our track over here, and we take a look at all the existing bugs that are in here. We can see that's the bug that I just filed, and there's the screenshot down there. I must just not have shown up until I click save. And what we can do here is we can actually create a test case from this bug. And so what we'll automatically do is say, all right, we found a valid scenario where this is broken. Instead of relying on the chance of hitting this in another exploratory testing session in the future, let's make sure that we're explicitly testing this when moving forward. And so that's a good example of where you can see it's not exploratory testing versus formal test case management, but it's actually both of those working in parallel. And so if I create this test case now, the other nice thing that it's going to do for me is it automatically scoped my actions. Okay, so now the test case is almost ready for me to start. The one other thing I may want to come in here and do is say insert a step and say open WPF application, just so that the user knows where to get started if they're testing this again. Make sure text box and label on page one okay. So now that becomes a formal test case, and we can track that moving forward. So again, no rocket science here, but it's a really nice thing that we added to the tool set. In the next release, we're going to be doing even more to support exploratory testing, so I'm pretty excited about maybe coming back next year and showing that to you. Test automation principles. You know, I showed this yesterday. I didn't really talk about when you would actually automate a test. I really spent most of my time showing you how you would automate, but oftentimes I find when talking to testing teams, they want to automate too much. You know, there are some things that are really worthwhile to automate, and there's some things that you'll frankly be wasting your time if you try to automate. And so the first thing I say is, you know, can this even be automated? And depending on the type of test automation framework that you're using, the answer may be no. For example, our test automation framework for coded UI tests works really, really well with, you know, web applications. Works really well with Silverlight 4 applications, but if you're testing Flash applications, Flash doesn't give us those accessibility hooks that we need in order to actually generate the automated tests for that. So in that case, it may not work. Was it built with testability in mind? So are the development teams going to be going out and changing the UI a lot, renaming the names of controls? You know, that's something we need to take into account. Maybe we don't even have access to that particular control. It comes from another third party, so it's not within our domain to understand which changes may be happening. And so it may be that our automated tests become really fragile over time as people start making updates. And then if it's not suitable for full automation, what about partial automation? So what about being able to automate the point of deploying this out to your test environments without necessarily running the automated test? That could actually save the tester the majority of the time that they need to save, so that they could just come in the morning and they've already got an infrastructure that's ready to go to perform their tests against. What's the cost of the automation? You know, if it's going to cost a lot for you to write the test that you need, but it's only going to be a few minutes of a manual tester's time each and every day to run those tests, and you only need those tests for another 3 weeks before you ship the application, then maybe it doesn't make sense. You know, I'm sure you already go through a lot of these in your own estimates. What's the cost of maintaining this test over time? What's the benefit of automating this test? Should we design big end-to-end tests or more modular tests? So this is a good example of where you can say, well, I may want to create an end-to-end test that starts with the user logging into the system, and then they, you know, do something against the system, and then they pay with a credit card, and they check out, and they log out of the system. And that might be a good test to determine whether or not the end-to-end site functionality works. But from a reporting perspective, coming in each morning and saying, okay, which test failed, it's not really all that helpful if you just get a report that says that the end-to-end test failed and you have no idea where along that process it actually failed. So what I usually like to do is actually create multiple tests, and then you can run those individually so that you can say whether or not a given test within that sequence failed. And then if you want to, you can then create another container test that ties all of those together. So you can take an ordered test, you can add all those individual tests to that ordered test, and then you kind of get the best of both worlds there. And then again, you know, some of these I'm getting redundant with my talking points here. This is the test automation platform support for our test automation within coded UI tests. I know this is an eye chart slide. I'm not going to spend any more time on it. I showed it yesterday, but it's in my slide deck if you want to go back and take a look at that. Now, test configurations are our way of representing within the product which places do you need to run these tests. And so this is, again, going back to the decision of, do we need to test this against Windows XP and Windows 7 and Internet Explorer 6? And so within the product, you can actually represent these test configurations, and then we'll track those within your reports for you automatically. And so you can talk to the marketing team, or you can survey your customer base to find out how they're currently using your product. Where do you need to test that? Maybe in the last release, you noticed that you had a lot of bugs that were coming out of one particular configuration. And if that's an important configuration for you to test, you may want to beef up that particular configuration within your test matrices. What configurations are likely to surface individual problems? So between the test team and the development team, you may be able to look at a given user story and determine whether or not the functionality is being implemented as server-side functionality or client-side functionality. If you have a web scenario that you're testing and it relies on JavaScript, but we all know that the way that each browser implements JavaScript can be slightly different. And so that's a test that you'll want to run in multiple different browsers to make sure you're getting good coverage there. But if you're simply testing that a transaction happens correctly on the server, maybe you can just get away with testing that on one particular browser. And so you can actually override on a test case by test case basis which test cases you want to test on each type of iteration there, or each type of configuration. And then you can pare that down as well by looking at maybe where are we testing too redundantly? And where can we actually save ourselves some testing effort? So if your product, for example, needs to work on Windows Server 2008 and Windows Server 2008 R2, and it also needs to be supported on 32-bit and 64-bit configurations, you may decide that it doesn't make sense for you to test on Windows Server 2008 64-bit because you're already testing 64-bit by virtue of running on Windows Server 2008 R2. So you may be able to simplify your test matrix, especially if you have limited resources, which I'm sure we all do. If you have unlimited resources, I'd love to come work for you. And then test settings are slightly related to test configurations, but these relate back to what information do you automatically want to gather while your tests are being run. So I've mentioned a few examples like video recordings, system information, event logs, IntelliTrace files. So this is a question that can get informed by talking to the development team and deciding if you got a bug on this particular user story, what type of information would you need to diagnose and understand that bug? And so you may look at that user story and say, okay, well, our backend database for this particular user story requires SQL Server, and that runs on this machine over here. So it would be nice to understand if we're out of RAM on that box or out of disk space, or maybe if there's an event log we can capture, we can start to look at that type of information. You may say, well, this is a test that actually requires a lot of client-side interaction. And so if the tester clicks on this button as opposed to this button, then they're actually following the test case wrong. And so it's really important to understand which button they clicked on. So there, it would be nice to have a video recording. And you may decide that there's custom things that you want to capture as well. And with our framework, you can actually create a custom data diagnostic adapter. It sounds scarier than it is. It's basically just an adapter that you plug into the test settings configuration and say, when this test fails, or when a tester files a bug from this particular test, what information do you want to go out and capture automatically? And so one example might be if you have a log file that gets written as part of your application runs, maybe you want to automatically go out and grab that log file as opposed to relying on the tester to remember to go out and package up that log file and attach it to the test. And you can even do things like zip that log file before you attach it to the test results. So really there's a lot of options here. What is the overhead associated? You know, there's sometimes a temptation to say, well, let's just capture everything. But as you can imagine, with IntelliTrace files, with video recordings, the size of these can start to add up. So that's why you really want to decide what, on a per-test basis, you want to capture. And you can also have your testers run with different test settings throughout the course of their day. So they could run with a lightweight diagnostics for maybe 90% of their tests. And then if they encounter a bug where they think that it might be really important for the development team to have some more information, they can rerun that test with a full diagnostics test settings configuration and then file that information back to TFS. And then I mentioned the custom data diagnostic adapters. Now, when you scale this out across multiple machines, we actually have a really nice test architecture to be able to do that. Basically, Team Foundation Server becomes the heart of this entire solution, and we have controllers and agents which then can interact with the individual tests. And so in a fully scaled out test environment, you'll see something like this, where you have Team Foundation Server at the core. Team Build is then responsible for either compiling your application or then pushing it out to one or more environments. So you can actually have your physical environments or your virtual environments participate in workflows where they set up, you know, the SQL Server script on this particular box, and then they run an MSI file on this particular box. And then the next thing is that the test controller walks into that scenario and says, okay, which test do we need to run on each one of these environments? And you can tag your environments with our product to say, this is a 32-bit environment running Windows Server 2008 R2. So it knows that if it needs to run a test matching that particular configuration, it will look for a box or an agent, rather, that's available and matches that particular configuration. And then once it runs those tests, they'll then be reported back to the test controller. So you can see that in an aggregated reported view back centrally within TFS. So let me just quickly show you where test configurations surface. If you go back to your plan and go to properties, those actually just show up down here. So you've got test settings. And you can see here I have two different types of test settings to give the testers flexibility about which one they want to choose. If I open up lightweight diagnostics, You can see here that I have actions turned on, which allows me to, as you saw in my last demo, it allows me to say that the tester typed AAAAA in this field, then they clicked go. That's the type of information that, gets captured with the action recording. So as long as it's a supported test or a supported development stack that we can use with our automation framework, we'll get that information for us automatically, and then that can show up back to the developers so they can see at a glance what you clicked on. We also have system information turned on, video recordings, and then most of these have configurations as well. So I can click on the video recording configuration, and I can say how many frames per second do we want to capture. I can go back to the event log and say which specific event log information do we want to capture. Maybe I just want hardware events off of this particular machine. And then you don't see it on my VM up here, but if you had multiple machines within your environment, like a database server and a web server and a client machine, you would actually see multiple roles listed here, and then you can define each one of those roles independently of the other. So video recording you capture off the client machine, event log you capture off of the server machine, right? So you can make that decision. And then the test configurations actually surface down here under configurations. And so here you can see these are the different configurations that I've decided to create. So I want to I want to test everything under Windows Server 2008 and IE8, Windows 7 and IE8, and Vista and IE7, right? And I can come in here and manage configuration variables. So maybe if I wanted to add another one which had to do with the bitness of the machine that I was testing, I could add that. Language configurations, I could add that in here. And then I can add that to my overall test configuration. The other thing you might want to use this for is if you have some dependent library that you use, like maybe you're using a library from a third party that on some machines within your corporate infrastructure, they're running version 1, and in some machines, they're running version 1.1, but you may want to test the differences between that library so that as your IT teams roll that out to new clients with 1.1, then you aren't going to have any surprises that that's well tested. So this could really be used to represent any different type of configuration you want to reflect. At the end of the day, we don't care what you represent within here. And then by default, that gets applied to all test cases within your plans, but you can also come into an individual test case. And you can override the configurations for that individual test case. So I can say, I need to test this particular test case under these different configurations. And then when you do that, and you flip back over to the testing tab, it's now actually going to show up in the list three different times. And it's basically telling the tester they need to run that test three different times. So for the lab management section, I'm going to go very quickly through this because I imagine most of you are not responsible for setting up a lab management infrastructure. But for those of you that are or might find yourself in this situation, lab management is really the crux of everything that I showed you. It really requires you to be not only a development expert and a testing expert, but also an IT expert as well. So it's kind of fun getting to exercise all those different skill sets I found in setting up my own lab management environment, but it can also be somewhat frustrating at times if you're looking for a resource or if you're trying to get something working. And so this is just a quick collection of links I've compiled. We have capacity planning tools now that you can use to actually figure out how many physical machines you need based on the number of configurations and environments you need to test and the horsepower of your existing hardware. So you can take a look at that. There's a nice tool for actually generating some of that information. And I should mention all of these links are going to work once you download my slide deck, so I'll make that available after the conference. The next thing that we did is we invested heavily in refining our MSDN library documentation. So we've been talking to lots of early adopters of the lab management technology. And so even if you looked at that in the past, we're actually refining that about once every month or two. So if you go back and look at lab management now, there's lots of really practical guides here. So how do you set up agents and controllers for labs? What firewalls do I need to have open? We have a VM prep tool that we can use to actually help you automatically install all of the agents you need. onto a given virtual machine. So you don't even have to fire up that virtual machine. You just run the VM prep tool against that virtual machine, and it takes care of installing the agents and sysprepping the machine for you. Just a couple more in here. So a lot of people have different topologies within their organization, and so we've taken a look at different examples of topologies that you might encounter within your environment, and we've tried to document best practices for those given topologies. So you may find one that maps closely to what you're using, or at least gives you some ideas of ways you might want to set this up within your environment. If you have geographically distributed labs, this actually creates a really interesting situation for lab management. We have this within Microsoft, where we have a lot of our testing teams located in China and India. And of course, the development teams are based in Redmond. And so how do you actually create those lab-managed environments so that the testers in India and China are going to have a good experience connecting to those? Well, if you're housing the virtual machines in Redmond, that's not going to work very well, because they have to then remote into those machines, and they have all the latency that's associated with that. So you want to run those lab-managed environments locally if you can, and you don't want to create the builds of those environments in Redmond and then have to push those over the network. So our infrastructure allows you to actually set up multiple host groups so that overnight we can actually automatically generate lab environments to run within Redmond and then lab environments to run within India, and then the clients have settings which define the affinity for which one they're going to connect to. So everybody gets a local experience there, and there's a help topic which describes how to do that. Let's see, a couple others in here. A lot of people say, well, I want to take advantage of IntelliTrace and video recordings and all this rich information, but I don't want it living in my Team Foundation server forever, right? And so we published a test attachments cleaner recently that allows you to point at old test data. Maybe you want to delete everything that's older than 2 months or anything that's associated with iteration one. You want to delete out of the system. Now you can do that quite easily. Creating VMs, there's just a lot of things in here. I'm just going to fast forward through some of these. And then the troubleshooting guide and a list of all of the ports and protocols. And the product team also does a lot of blogs and produces a lot of videos related to lab management as well. And then the number one question I get about lab management is, what about VMware? Can I use this if I'm using VMware? If you've looked at lab management, you'll know that by default we actually support Hyper-V. And if you're running VMware, there's two stories. One is, you know, you can convert to Hyper-V to take full advantage of lab management. That's not always an option for people. If you want to continue to run VMware, you can still get some benefit by using lab management. Basically, what you can do is you can set up a VMware environment and have it participate in the build workflows so that it automatically can install the files that are coming out of your build process. You can even have it participate in test automation as well. What you won't get primarily is the built-in snapshotting capability. So that's something that you could automate yourselves by adding to a custom build script if you wanted to, and there's some more information in this help topic that describes how to do that. But you won't, for example, out of the box get a system where if we find a bug, we automatically create a snapshot, or if we get finished installing all the components on a given virtual environment, let's automatically snapshot that. So with that in mind, yes, you can use VMware, but there are some limitations. And those limitations are effectively the same as the physical machine limitations as well. So if you want to participate in a build, deploy, test workflow for physical machines, maybe you can't virtualize some of the applications that you need to support. Maybe you have specialized hardware that you need to test that goes along with that. You can still participate in a lot of this, just not everything. And then, of course, if you didn't see Feature Pack 2 come out, Feature Pack 2 adds a lot of really nice features for testing, support for Firefox, support for Silverlight 4. Yesterday, I showed the coded UI test editor. And then finally, if you haven't installed Visual Studio 2010 Service Pack 1 yet, I definitely recommend that you do that. Specifically for the Microsoft Test Manager, there are a lot of fit and finish things that went into improving that, because that was our V1 release. So now, you know, as everyone says, Microsoft gets it right in the Service Pack. Go install the service pack. So I went a little bit longer than I had hoped, so let's go ahead and wrap here, but I will stick around if anyone has any questions, and thanks very much for coming to the session.